From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norian. Welcome to Coast AM. Last hour of the program tonight, an evening of adventure and space, the lives of stars with Ken Croswell. Get ready for that. But here's what's happening. Officials fear now more than 100,000 people have died as a result of Tuesday's 7.0 magnitude earthquake in Haiti. And some are saying as many as 500,000 could be dead. Nobody really knows the numbers. This is a disaster of biblical proportions. The capital, Port-au-Prince, is flattened. Hospitals are gone. Medical supplies and heavy equipment are desperately needed. The country's prime minister said the death toll could be in the hundreds of thousands. Thousands of injured people waited for care outside of badly damaged hospitals, while an unknown number remain trapped inside collapsed buildings. Basic services like water and electricity are out. A pediatrics nurse who works at an orphanage just outside of the capital city said aftershocks are still happening from Haiti's huge earthquakes, the 7.0 magnitude quake, Haiti's worst in two centuries. It struck south of the capital on Tuesday. Susan Westwood from Scotland told the BBC that aftershocks are hitting her building every 10 minutes.
Just now we're still seeing tremors from that quake almost constantly. And every 10 minutes we get a bigger aftershock which makes the building sway. And that kind of aftershock activity really hasn't lessened since the last night.
What is the scale of devastation where you are, and what buildings are still standing?
We're lucky in that we are in a comparatively wealthy area, so most of the buildings where I am are still standing. Actually, none of our buildings sustained any structural damage at all. And we do intersperse amongst the wealthier households have little huts where poorer families live. And just as we look out from our balcony at the top of the house, we can see that some of them have fallen.
You are a paediatrics nurse. Are you able to make an assessment at this moment of the impact, certainly on kids?
I'm very concerned about their access to fresh drinking water, and that would be my concern. I would be concerned that we're going to see illnesses like dysentery, that children may not have access to water at all. That's going to be an immediate concern. Food is the next thing.
What a tragedy. The nurse said she fears that sick children will not have access to drinking water or food. Now, the American Red Cross has pledged an initial $1 million to assist communities there impacted by the earthquake in Haiti, and it is prepared to take further action as local responders assess the situation. A number of those from Los Angeles left today to head for Haiti. The American Red Cross has made available all of its relief supplies from its warehouse in Panama, which would provide for basic needs for about 5,000 families. Keep in mind there are about 9 million people on the island of Haiti. In addition, it is deploying a disaster management specialist to Haiti and has additional disaster specialists on standby if needed. We have a link at coasttocoastam.com on our website to the Red Cross if you'd like to help out as well. Nestle will begin using heat-treated flour in its Toll House refrigerated cookie dough months after the company temporarily pulled the product off the store shelves after the FDA found evidence of E. coli contamination. The unit of Nestle said it will halt production at its Danville, Virginia plant until January 25th in order to convert the plant to use the heat-treated flour. In June, Nestle recalled the cookie dough after the FDA said it was investigating possible E. coli-related illnesses that might have been related to the eating of raw cookie dough. Our food safety expert, Jeff Nelkin, on the line with us now. Jeff, will this plant that will heat up the flour, will that help? Will that work?
Well, again, it's another step that they're taking to make the product a little bit safer.
Well, but will it work?
Again, you know, in some of the research that was done at the plant, they found some of the equipment that wasn't properly being maintained and that there were areas that weren't being cleaned correctly, and that could have been a source of potential contamination. So they really were never able to identify any specific smoking guns other than, you know, some of the equipment that was rusty and hadn't been cleaned and sanitized on a regular basis.
Jeff, why do these companies seem to take action after the fact? I mean, this heat-treated program, for example, why weren't they doing this all the time?
Well, you know, they have what they call, like, third-party auditors, you know, outside people that come in and are supposed to catch things that are going to contribute to a problem. And this is one of the big questions that came up, was that there, you know, were, you know, Nestle's has a very thorough type of, you know, check and balances program, and still this got by them. So they're even going to be doing sampling as they produce the product and sample the product before they even let the product release to the public. Because again, you know, this is a situation where they didn't expect people to eat raw dough. And, you know, a lot of us, you know, when our moms were making dough, always, you know, used to lick
sure.
the bowl.
That's right. I remember that.
Right. So all of us are a little bit, you know, guilty of that. And it's, you know, a case of where, you know, if you bake a cookie, you kill the bacteria that's there. But if you eat the dough, and on the raw state, if there's any organisms there, then you're potentially setting yourself up for a problem.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. Jeff's a website linked up at our Twitter feed at Coast to Coast AM. The minute hand of the famous doomsday clock will be moved tomorrow afternoon in the very first time in 2 years. The timepiece in the New York area conveys just how closely humanity is to catastrophic destruction, which is represented by midnight. It was created by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists in 1947, 2 years after the U.S. dropped the first atomic bombs on Japan in World War II, and during the year, of course, of the Roswell incident. It was originally set at 7 minutes to midnight. The clock has been altered 18 times since then by the Bulletin's scientific board. That now includes Professor Stephen Hawking and 18 other Nobel laureates. The latest recorded time was 2 minutes to midnight in 1953 as the Cold War heated up between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Teddy Pendergrass, who became R&B's reigning star in the 70s and 80s with his forceful voice and passionate love ballads, and later became an inspirational figure after suffering a devastating car accident that left him paralyzed, is dead now at the age of 59. The singer's son, Teddy Pendergrass II, said his father died in suburban Philadelphia. The singer underwent colon cancer surgery 8 months ago and had, according to his son, a very difficult recovery. If you think staying in bed on the weekends will make up for a week's worth of sleep deprivation, think again. A new study finds that going long periods without sleep can lead to a sort of sleep debt that simply cannot be undone with a little extra snoozing from time to time. It won't work. Such chronic sleep loss may eventually interfere with a person's performance on tasks that require focus, becoming particularly noticeable at nighttime when the body's natural sleep-wake cycle isn't giving you that extra boost. The Federal Reserve banks made a profit of $52 billion in 2009, reaping extra income on the government securities they bought in an effort to stabilize the financial system. That's a lot of money. If you go up to our feature story at coasttocoastam.com, you will see what looks like trees on Mars. Natural, erupting trees, are they? Well, they are dust clouds, according to scientists from NASA. They're saying it's just an illusion. Or is it? Richard C. Hoagland, our science advisor, head of the EnterpriseMission.com. That doesn't look like an illusion to me, Richard.
Well, that's not exactly the way you look at it. First of all, it's a color picture taken by the high-rise MRO camera, incredible camera, with basically a big telescope looking down on Mars. The first thing you notice is the pink color of the sand dunes. That's the real color of Mars. That's the dust.
Yeah,
that's blown around for millions of years because it hasn't rained there in, you know, God knows how long. It's the same color that you see when you take a picture with an amateur telescope and a camera from the Earth. So that's the real Mars. Now, those little dark streaks that are going down the dunes, the NASA caption explains, are really avalanches caused by a combination of CO2 frost melting in the spring, because it's spring now on Mars where this was taken, not far from the North Pole of Mars, And the dunes are revealing darker material underneath the overcoating of dust on the surface caused by the dust storms. And it's kind of like the black basalt beaches of Hawaii, where you put stuff on top of them. If you scrape it off, you get the black basalt underneath. Well, that's what you're seeing here. Now, the key to this, I mean, they look like something branchy, like a... But they're not, because there's no shadows. The one thing that has a shadow right in the middle of one of the of that picture is a little reddish cloud. That is literally high-rise capturing one of these avalanches in progress, and the cloud is the dust raised by the avalanche as the stuff is cascading down the sand dune. So these really are sand dunes. NASA's really telling us the truth. And the thing that I'm really struck by in terms of this story is how irrelevant it is, really irrelevant, George, to the big thing that space could be doing for humanity tonight in terms of your lead story.
Oh, amazing.
Years ago, my friend, departed friend, Kraft Erica, invented as part of the original NASA program something called Soletta and Lunetta.
What is that?
These are Italian terms for little sun, little moon. These were going to be huge mile-across mylar reflectors, mirrors, put in space by NASA so that you could refocus the beams on the night side of the Earth, and the rescue workers who literally have to stop because there's no light in Port-au-Prince at all tonight. There's no power. There's no electricity. They've been thrown back to the Stone Age, barely as they are above it when times are normal. These inventions by Kraft Erica, put in place by NASA, could reflect sunlight from out in space down into the darkened agony of Port-au-Prince, so that people could continue to rescue people alive in this golden 48 hours, or even if they're trapped in these collapsed buildings, they still are alive and they could be gotten out if someone could see to get to them without heavy equipment, et cetera, et cetera.
And as you know, Richard, we're going to have more and more catastrophes. Probably not a bad idea to work on that. Richard C. Hoagland's website, enterprisemission.com, and also darkmission.net. Richard, thank you. Up next, Bill McDonald joins us. We're going to be talking with a number of topics with Bill, including the biology of the Loch Ness Monster, the interface between some UFO occupants, and that's just a little bit. And that's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Let me tell you a little bit about Bill McDonald, his educational background in the field of military aviation via the Marine Corps and the California Army National Guard, combined with forensic anthropology. His work experience was as an undercover private investigator for over 12 years, working with the major metropolitan police departments, federal agencies, and the military. And at the same time, he was a precision fantasy, technical, scientific, and commercial illustrator who fell into forensics. McDonald received his BA degree from Cal State Fullerton in criminal justice, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Bill, how are you?
It's a pleasure, George. I hope everybody's hearing me okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Loud and clear, William, loud and clear. How's the artwork these days?
The artwork has been busy. I've had a burst of productivity in the last couple of months that came as family coffers continued to shrink and as income streams continued to wither. I suddenly was able to conclude a lot of different research lines, and I committed ink to paper, and I have several brand new portfolios that we have not posted, because every time we do, there's some very, very talented individuals out there that like to lift the images and post them all over numerous overseas venues.
Yeah. Yep, I can see that happening. Alien UFO Art, he does an incredible job just doing all kinds of different kinds of artwork that are related to some of the things we're talking about tonight. You know, your background is forensics. I keep, you watch shows like CSI and things like that. You're a forensic artist. What is that, Bill?
Forensics is defined as the process of inquest using processes such as legal argumentation. It is the investigation of all things using all disciplines that are applicable that pertain to the process of legal argumentation. And because, as you know, our system, which is the best in the world, is adversarial.
Yes.
And evidence has to be collected. It has to be properly maintained. People are responsible and accountable for how it is held. And then it has to be presented following specific and very strict rules of law. Detective methodology is just as precise. And I actually learned the tools and the tradecraft of what is an old-fashioned gumshoe prior to the coming of the internet. And then the internet just kind of added frosting to the cake in many ways.
Now, what's an old-fashioned gumshoe? What is that?
Sam Spade, Thomas Magnum, Sherlock Holmes.
Those folks, okay.
The old-fashioned private eye.
Okay.
Jim Rockford.
We don't do that anymore, though, do we?
It's a dying breed. A lot of off-duty cops, a lot of junior partners, junior attorneys and law firms, and just about anybody with any kind of an internet hookup has basically wiped a lot of the old-fashioned private investigative agencies, just caused them to die off like the dinosaurs.
And a forensic artist would sketch the scene?
Well, that's what makes me unusual. It's one of the reasons why I still survive. Detectives put cases, they gather evidence, they put their facts together, and they present what's called a report of investigation. And you list all your facts, basically in chronological order, and you may or may not, depending on who the client is, have a list of conclusions at the bottom. What makes me special is that whenever it pertains to anything, a scene, an object, an item, multiple witness descriptions, single witness descriptions of a person, place, or a thing, I can sit down and I can sketch in a sketch pad what it is the people claim they see or saw. Now, that can be an individual who committed a crime. It can be an item of some kind. It can be a scene. It can be a sequence. It can be the way cars came to rest after a traffic collision in a specific intersection. Sometimes you diagram things out. Sometimes you sketch things in more of a three-dimensional type sketching.
You're almost like the camera that wasn't there.
Exactly. There are so many situations, both in nature and in the daily processes of our lives, where we just don't have a camera. Even if you have a cell phone, it happens, you see it, but by the time you reach for your cell phone, it's over.
Indeed. So how did you turn that avocation into the field of ufology?
Well, that was very interesting because back in 1991-92, I was affiliated with a detective agency, which no longer exists. And we had a school teacher out of Long Beach, California, who was going into the tail end of the second trimester of a well-documented pregnancy. And she woke up one morning with her husband, and that pregnancy was no longer there. Her stomach was flat. The gynecologist, an OBGYN that examined her, found that her body had been restored to its pristine condition prior to the onset of her pregnancy, prior to conception. And various family members, a number of people in the school district, and law enforcement investigators were looking at her like, what did you do with your baby?
Exactly. Exactly.
And it became a nightmare, and relatives who were on her side contacted one of my bosses and said, hey, we want you guys to look into this. And we tended to look into rather unusual cases with rather unusual venues anyway. So it got tossed into my lap because he liked throwing, this particular boss liked throwing all the weird stuff at me. So I started the process step by step. I interviewed everybody very carefully, and I used a four-step interview process. found out that everybody was telling the truth as clear as they could based on the fact that their stories were gelling and there were no discrepancies in the different angles of approach that I used in my questioning.
Let's pick that up when we come right back, Bill. This is a fascinating story. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Sure is. We're with Bill McDonald tonight, and this story he's talking about is pretty incredible, how a woman who was pregnant simply didn't have her baby anymore with no signs of where the child went. We're going to be talking with him about that in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Let's pick up this incredible story, Bill. So the woman had no signs of having the child. It was gone. And police are saying, where's the child?
Right. Now, you have to understand that this was a multi-jurisdictional investigation because this was in association with a road trip that the young family took from their home, on the ocean. I think it's Ocean Boulevard or right down on Ocean Street or Ocean Boulevard in Long Beach.
Mm.
A beautiful little beachfront property that they rented. And they drove to Idlewild, California, where they spent the night. And they utilized, according to them, the 405 to the 5 to Highway 74, San Juan Capistrano, to Idlewild, which is a beautiful mountain community in Riverside, California. So there were police and sheriff personnel from several different departments that were very carefully surveying the credit card data and the actual physical receipts that the folks had, because this is like 19 years ago.
Right.
19 years ago. They surveyed all that. They surveyed for every single abortion clinic within 5 miles either side of that route. It was a very complex process involving cooperation of a lot of different people. Because even back then, California took a missing baby very seriously.
And there was just no way at this point they were thinking, ETs took this child.
Oh, well, nobody ever did. But what happened was, as you know, Bud Hopkins started putting his books out in 83, Missing Time,
mm-hmm.
and in 86, the Copley Woods case, which became a movie with Dan Curtis of Dark Shadows, Bud, and Tracy Torme, I think. So back to the story, that was starting to play in the back of my head. Wow, wouldn't it be funny if it was aliens? Meanwhile, they had people with dogs and people who were forensic accountants looking at every possible option of where this lady could have gone to get an abortion. But you have to remember that when women have an abortion, there's some medical evidence. There's bruising and there is effects on the tissue. And when this lady was subsequently examined by personnel that were approved by, the investigating authorities,
right.
They couldn't find any trace of a pregnancy, even though they had documentation.
So they were baffled.
It was baffling because her body wasn't showing any evidence of this first pregnancy. None. And while it was to the extent where her hymen was halfway recovered, not quite the way it was when she lost her virginity, but it was well established back again. And it was definitely a grist for a lot of conversation off duty. And the dogs never found any hint or any trace of any scent that could, be, human tissue, because a second trimester baby will smell like a cadaver when it's discarded, in the brush. And, in any of the places where they spot check, because California is a big place and you just can't run the dogs the entire route, but you can spot check in different locations. But they never keyed in on anything. So there was no evidence of any foul play whatsoever. And eventually, they no longer could afford to continue the case. They had to move on. And
was a polygraph test ever offered?
Yeah, both parents absolutely volunteered for polygraphs, and they passed them. The lady was nervous and scared, but she still passed. The husband was indignant and angry, as I would be. It was all completely understandable. There was nothing unexpected in their demeanor. So then I started running into people because I was also, pushing for my artwork on the Hollywood venue. And Bill Cosby had a game show that he was doing out of Philly at the time. And I met Barry Taff, one of your ghost guests.
Yeah.
And I met Barry Conrad, his buddy, at one of those deals. They introduced me to Don and Vicki Cooper. Vicki Cooper and Don Ecker at UFO Magazine. This is pre-Bill Burns. And I ended up doing a bunch of covers and a bunch of artwork for UFO Magazine back in the 90s before Bill took over. And then I met Melinda Leslie, Yvonne Smith, Deborah Troncalli, all of the people, and especially Dr. Carla Turner, who was like a sister to me. And a very precious, precious woman, and she died, and she missed out on my wedding, and it was really sad.
Sad for you, yeah.
But they helped me with lots of different opinions, lots of different ideas on what was going on. But they gave me the context that I needed to survey the UFO community for the following 19 years on the general patterns and trends based on what the witnesses have been describing and what precious little physical evidence has actually been collected. And I was able to survey, and eventually I was able to come to a wide variety of conclusions, which I have as unpublished manuscripts, and multiple portfolios of UFO encounters, UFO human contacts, a lot of very graphic abduction artwork, a lot of stuff that isn't on alienufoart.com because, you know, we are a business and it is a family site.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I have a lot of offline portfolio stuff that's very popular in Asia and very popular with, you know, certain books in the occult section and in the sci-fi section of your regular bookstores. And, you know, clients like Steve Alton and Paul Davids, who let me do the Roswell movie with him and Jeremy Kagan. You remember the Showtime Viacom movie Roswell with
sure.
McLaughlin and Xander Berkeley. I was a concept designer on that film.
Okay.
Then I did the tester model kit of the Roswell UFO. It was just a progression. It just went along with. And there were people who tooted my horn, and there were people who bickered with me. You know how the UFO community is. And in 95, I met my wife, and she grabbed me by both ears and yanked me out of all the bickering part of the fun of the UFO community. And she gave me a new focus in my life, which was focus on the research. Don't even waste your time with the politics anymore. Because now you got a family, you got to earn a living,
right.
And your research is on your beer time.
And the politics could bog you down.
Well, as you know, because there are wonderful, wonderful, wonderful researchers whom you've had on dozens upon dozens
yep.
of times, but put them in the same room with each other and it's fireworks. So, and, you know, and I have, you know, folks that, you know, will happily tell you that I'm the worst thing since stale bread. But, you know, life goes on. I became a husband and a father, and I had to go to work and earn a living and be responsible and hold down a mortgage. And so fun and games in Southern California had to dwindle off. And so my contacts became people who I truly respect it. I'm very privileged to have an ongoing relationship with, you know, Dr. Bob Wood, with Dr. Deborah Troncalli, with Jan Harzan at MUFON Orange County, with Hal Puthoff, with Dr. Eric Davis, both of whom are out of Austin.
All some of the best.
Yeah, some of the NIDS personnel. And they gave us opportunities. We got to experiment with ourselves with the remote viewing of the Sherman Ranch at Skinwalker Ridge. We had the opportunity to compare notes on the Roswell case. You know, NIDS personnel were very cordial to us, and it was coast to coast that put them onto me back in 1999 when Whitley brought me on for my first six visits, both on coast and on Dreamland back when he was guest hosting.
Right.
So Whitley brought me on first. Later I went on with Art, and still later I had Mike Siegel.
Mm-hmm.
And then you, and then Art some more, and then you, and it was just wonderful because Coast made it possible for me to network with really great scientific minds, people who were open to the possibilities, but who were firmly grounded in science and detective methodology. And one of my favorite things that I love to tell physicists is every good physicist needs a damn good detective on his team.
That's right.
And a good artist, because a lot of those guys, they convey, and I've learned a lot of physics, even though I can't do a lick of math, and they sit there doing all their equations and everything, and I have to figure out in, you know, Queen's English what it all means, and then I try to draw.
And illustrate it, yeah.
What it is that they're trying to convey. But how do you draw hyperspace? How do you draw subspace or space fold? It's a real challenge.
Well, when you were doing all of this, what were your conclusions about this woman? Did she have dreams of being abducted?
Well, she was like yes, absolutely. She ended up having hypnotic regression with somebody that was sanctioned by the Riverside police, or actually it was the sheriff's department out there. She talked to a number of psychiatrists and psychiatric personnel that were, you know, at the request of the local district attorney in her area. She, you know, they were baffled. And, of course, folks who were familiar with John Mack's work up in Boston,
sure,
you know, the peer organization, they, you know, were starting to machinate behind closed doors that, you know, maybe it was a paranormal situation, because spontaneous abortions are real. They actually happen, but it leaves physical evidence outside the body. Spontaneous absorption is extremely rare and usually only happens in the earliest part of the first trimester.
Yeah, not the second.
Exactly, because fully formed babies have survived in the second trimester outside of the body. They're preemies. Their lungs are not developed. They have to be in an almost pure oxygen environment. And most die, especially back in those days. But every once in a while, you had one that survived. So, I mean, it was baffling. And then, of course,
she must have been in shock. The father must have been in shock.
Well, it was brutal on them, but they went on to have other children, and they also went on to have additional encounters with the visitors that were abducting them and apparently generations of family past. It was your classic Bud Hopkins, Whitley Strieber, Dave Jacobs-style multi-generational abduction story. Except this was my case, and, you know, these folks are my witnesses.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I guard them very preciously because they still have careers. He's an aerospace engineer. He's now very highly placed, you know, in Southern California.
What does he think, the father? What did the husband? What does he think happened?
It took him the better part of 5 years, but he became interested in UFOs. He became interested.
Yeah.
He didn't have a choice. They even started listening to Art Bell, and they talked to me constantly. And by that time, I was starting to date some well-known abductees that you also have on a regular basis on the program. And, you know, it was, you know, just a time in my life where I was deeply ensconced, and I managed to thoroughly survey and digest all the patterns and trends in everybody's research, because no matter how cantankerous or ornery folks could be, they did share with me, because I had one thing that they didn't have, and that was an ability to draw.
Yes.
And I was pretty generous, because I didn't charge a whole lot of money in those days. And then my wife came along.
Did some of them ever show emotion, Bill, after you ended up drawing whatever they were
Absolutely.
Talking about?
Absolutely. In fact, that's one of the ways. And that's one of the final tests, is when, whether it's a Roswell guy looking at a reconstruction of the spacecraft and flight crew, or whether it's an abductee or family of abductees looking at occupants, flight crew, whoever the abductors are, the technician class and the administrative class, which are your talls and your shorts, the hybrids and the neonates. Aliens, which Ed Conroy, Whitley Strieber, and a large number of other people, independently of each other, were independently verifying. And that's where you get these second and early third trimester fetuses that are pulled out of the uterus, artificially matured at that point, and then they run around like the small grays, performing, you know, worker-type functions in what can best be described as a hive-type society.
Bizarre. Now, how did these hybrids look like? What are they? What are
well,
they
the hybrids are exactly like what's been described to you dozens of times. They have hair on their heads.
Big eyes.
They have larger than normal eyes, but they have irises and sclera as often as not. There's a possibility that they wear some kind of lens over their eyes because it seems like humanoids that travel in space are very sensitive to light. And so they have to have filters of some kind. And if they're not wearing some kind of spacesuit or helmet, then they have to have some kind of something that's like a contact lens technology that's, you know, 2,000 years in advance of what we have.
What we've got, yeah.
And
it's probably like a contact lens computer chip combined or something.
Well,
you know,
remember, the aliens produce technology that mimics living tissue in layers that can be as thinnest layers of tissue in any organ of the body. And that includes processing layers where the pattern looks more like living cell tissue, like neuroganglia tissue, rather than the grid squares that you see with the kind of microprocessors that we manufacture. But again, that's because it looks like their technology has grown following the blueprint of chain molecules, similar to the way things gestate, following the pattern that's set by DNA molecules in a womb or an egg. And their technology has grown rather than manufactured from sub-assemblies.
David Jacobs would say, Bill, these aren't being done. These abductions, these hybrid births aren't being done for friendly purposes.
We're being exploited. We're being ranched. My Oasis Earth hypothesis was developed independently of Dave and his second book, his follow-up book that he did. But I concur with him 100%. And John Mack also tended to be reserved in how friendly these guys were. Carla Turner felt that it was something far more diabolical than even what Dave Jacobs suggests. And she, and I've never had the privilege of meeting him, but the French-Belgian scientist that Hal Puthoff associates with, I'm trying to remember his name, Francois Truffaut played him loosely in the Close Encounters of the Third Kind movie. I wish I could meet him, but he's aging, but also I think he felt that they were a major threat. I'm trying to remember his name. It'll come to my head in a few minutes. But my research strongly suggests that we are livestock, that we are an agricultural commodity that these beings, and they harvest DNA in order to plug in, because in my opinion, most grays are females.
And there's got to be something unique about us.
Well, what it is that our mammalian Y chromosomes have not degraded past the point where we are no longer able to reproduce.
We're getting close to that, though.
Well, Brian Sykes, one of Art's favorite guests, has a number of geneticists all over the world now that actually are concluding the same thing that he is, that the Y chromosome is in a state of degradation, that it's continuing to collect more and more junk DNA, more and more molecular garbage that's making it harder for Y chromosomes in the amelogen and locus to perform their function.
Let's take this break, Bill. We'll come back and talk more about that. Also get your description of some of these classes of UFOs and move into Nessie and other lake monsters on Coast to Coast AM.